Okay, it's good to be back with you. I heard that West finished everything last week. Since we're live, I better keep talking. We're ready to get started. Last week, West finished up the previous section, the section on household relationships. A point of what we're of the schedule. We're going to be going over these notes this week and next week. And then I'll have to let you know about the, today is the 8th, right? Yes, I'm here the 8th and the 15th. We'll have to let you know about the 22nd and 29th. I'll be talking to Wes to see if he can pick up for me. So do plan on being here next week. And these notes will be good for both today and next week. Now I heard that Wes finished, everything last week. Carol said he rushed through it. Probably didn't want too many questions about, the Bible's view of slavery. Part of it entailed last week. I don't know if you have a bunch of questions left over from that, but let me encourage you. When we finish Colossians, we're going into Philemon. And Philemon is a letter from Paul to Philemon about Onesimus, who is a runaway slave from Philemon that found his way to Rome and to Paul, and he was converted under Paul's ministry. He was converted through Paul, and Paul is returning Onesimus to Philemon with two letters. This letter to Philemon that we're going to go into, and we're going to see how Paul talks about Philemon's relationship with Onesimus, and we'll get some real insight there as far as the Bible and slavery goes. Okay? The other letter that Onesimus was carrying was what? Why do you think that we study Colossians and Philemon together? Because that's right. Onesimus was carrying both letters. It's also probably why Paul spent so much time on the master-servant relationship last week. I mean, he spent twice as much time with that relationship as he did with husband, wife, and parent, child in his letter to the Colossians. And it's, you know, more than likely the fact that a runaway slave who got saved was carrying that letter. So if you have more questions regarding the Bible and its view of slavery, how it treats it, why we don't read any condemnations of it in there, just exactly the biblical perspective on slavery, we will have opportunity to go through that when we're in the book of Philemon. Tonight, we're going to start this last section of the main body of Colossians, chapter 4, verses 2 through 6. So let me read these five verses. Paul writes this: "Continue steadfastly in prayer, being watchful in it with thanksgiving. At the same time, pray also for us, that God may open to us a door for the word to declare the mystery of Christ, on account of which I am in prison, that I may make it clear which is how I ought to speak. Walk in wisdom toward outsiders, making the best use of the time. Let your speech always be gracious, seasoned with salt, so that you may know how you ought to answer each person. So that's the section that we're starting in tonight. And got a couple of explanatory paragraphs there for you of this section. It's a brief section, isn't it? It's only five verses compared to the other two parts, 6 through 23, and 3:1 through 4:1. Those are large sections here. This is just a five verse section. But I thought Moo had very good explanation of how this relates to the rest of the main body. So I didn't quote him precisely. I reworded and rearranged some of the things he said, but this is taken mainly from his commentary on Colossians and Philemon, which is very good commentary. And yes, Carol, it's in the pastoral office too. I know that you look at commentaries when you're studying. Okay. This paragraph, these five verses, close the main body of Paul's letter. The main body being chapter 2, verse 6 through chapter 4, verse 6. Remember that first part? He had a long introduction. Chapter 1, verse 3 through chapter 2, verse 5. We went through that. That was just the introduction. The main body of the letter is chapters 2, verse 6 through chapter 4, verse 6. And this central section, this main body, this central section of Colossians is driven by commands that lay out how believers are to live under the lordship of Christ, the head of creation and the church. I forget how many commands it was. Remember, I told you there was almost no commands in the introductory section. Then when you get in the main body, it's in the high 20s or high 30s, the number of commands just in those two chapters, chapter 2, verse 6 through chapter 4, verse 6. So that's why we say that that main body was driven by commands which lay out how believers are to live under the lordship of Christ. Remember, that's chapter 2, verses 6 and 7. Those are our key verses to this whole letter. Paul says in those two verses, therefore, as you have received Christ Jesus the Lord, so walk in him, having been rooted and now being built up in him and established in the faith, just as you were taught, and now abounding in thanksgiving. So those are the key verses that open the main section of the body, and that main, those two chapters, the main section, just loaded with commands, because Paul is telling us how to walk, how to live under the lordship of Christ. The first part of this main section, chapter 2, verses 6 through 23, and in particular verses 8 through 23, the first part of this main section focused on asserting Christ's exclusive role in salvation and Christian living. You remember that? And that he had to do that. He had to start with that because of the rival claims being put forward by the false teachers. You remember the essence of those claims by the false teachers? Okay, so what is it? Exactly. Yes, exactly. What is? You fill in the blank, and that story, that, yes, Seth said that the false teachers were claiming that, yes, you need Christ, but you need to go beyond Christ. You need more than Christ for full spiritual fulfillment, for complete spiritual fulfillment. And so that's why in that first section of the main body, Paul focused on insisting on Christ's exclusive role both in salvation and Christian living. Because you know what? Christian living is part of salvation, right? Salvation is you've been delivered from the penalty and power of sin. Christian living is you are presently being delivered from the pollution and practice of sin. In the future, future salvation is you're going to be delivered from the possession and the presence of sin. Isn't that marvelous? I mean, that's essentially what Wes was saying this morning. The reason that we struggle in the Christian life is because we haven't received all of our salvation. The rest of the salvation we're going to receive is being delivered from the even possessing sinful desires, corrupt desires, and being delivered from the very presence of sin. That's on the horizon, folks. That's going to be tremendous. Meanwhile, we've been delivered from the penalty and power of sin, and we are presently in this battle of being delivered from the pollution and practice of sin. You like all those P's? I try to put all those P's in there to make it easy to remember. Penalty and power, that's past. Pollution and practice, that's present. Possession and presence, that's future. So, anyway, and Paul had to insist on Christ's exclusive role in salvation and Christian living. That's what that first part of the main body is taken up with. Then in the second part of this main section, chapter 3, verse 1 through chapter 4, verse 1, his concern with the false teachers fades. It fades much more to the background. You know that it's always lurking. But his focus on the false teachers really fades. And what replaces it is instructions for Christian living in general. Okay? So remember, he's telling us how to live under the lordship of Christ. And so the first section is the don'ts. Do not be taken in by the vain philosophy of these false teachers, the empty, worthless philosophy of these false teachers. Do not be taken in by their just say no campaign. Okay? And then the second part is the positive approach. This is what it looks like to live under the lordship of Christ. But what I want you to see in both of these parts, that first and second part, Paul's instructions were pretty much inward looking, focusing on our living and our relationships. They were inward looking to the church. Okay? Now this third major section here, chapter 4, verses 2 through 6, Paul turns the look from inward to outward. This third and closing part of the main section looks outward with a focus on Paul's evangelistic works and believers' relationships with non-Christians. Okay? Does that sound threatening? Man, I'm telling you, this section, these five verses were so convicting to me. I was telling Pam, you know, I think it was yesterday, I was telling her, man, I'm enjoying this, but I am so convicted. So I'm going to get to drag you guys along with me here tonight. The paragraph is divided into two basic parts by commands in verse 2 and verse 5. Verse 2, he says, continue. That's the command. In verse 5, the command is walk. So, and those two commands divide those five verses into two main sections. So verses 2 through 4, continue in prayer. And verses 5 through 6, walk in wisdom. Now, how are those related? Well, as we go through it, as you read through it, hopefully you'll see that the flow of thought is pretty easy to follow in these verses. And I've got it diagrammed there for you in the notes there. The flow of thought is easy to follow. First, there's a general encouragement to pray in verse 2. And then secondly, a request to pray for Paul's evangelistic ministry. And then exhortations regarding the Colossians' evangelistic ministry. Don't look at this as Paul being sneaky and bringing up evangelism. Hey, you guys pray. By the way, while you're praying, pray for my evangelistic outreach. And how are you guys doing? That's not a sneaky approach by Paul to get to evangelism. As a matter of fact, here's what we need. Here's the big takeaway here, I think, anyway, of this third main body. And this is what hit me like a thunderclap. I hadn't really seen these five verses in this light before. But this third part of the main body of the letter highlights the reality that biblical Christianity is an evangelizing and praying way of life. So ask me the two things I struggle with. And these verses say, well, in biblical Christianity, that's a way of life. Not struggling with those, but doing those. That's a way of life. That's what biblical Christianity is. It's an evangelizing and praying way of life. That way of life is integral to living under the lordship of Christ. So hopefully I've just now drug you into my conviction. So we need to look at this. And we're also going to eventually, maybe next week, answer the question of how do we know for sure that Paul's talking about our evangelistic efforts in this section. But anyway, so let me reread this passage again just to get it fresh in our minds as we work through these questions. Oh, and by the way, I've those two main parts, verses 2 through 4 and verses 5 and 6, you see how I've laid them out there. 2 through 4, Paul is telling us to pray persistently for the spread of the gospel. 5 and 6, he's telling us to walk wisely to attract others. Let me read these verses again and you see if you can pick up on this flow of thought now that I've mentioned it. He writes, continue steadfastly in prayer, being watchful in it with thanksgiving. At the same time, pray also for us, that God may open to us a door for the word to declare the mystery of Christ, on account of which I am in prison, that I may make it clear, which is how I ought to speak. Walk in wisdom toward outsiders, making the best use of the time. Let your speech always be gracious, seasoned with salt, so that you may know how you ought to answer each person. Okay, let's work through these. Verse 2. Paul says, continue steadfastly in prayer, being watchful in it with thanksgiving. First question there in your notes. Paul tells us to continue steadfastly in prayer, first half of the verse 2. And then I ask this question. What does that tell us about the easiest aspect of prayer? You ever think of it from that? Paul's telling us to continue steadfastly in prayer. Does that by implication tell us what the easiest aspect of prayer is? In. Yeah, so what Ian is saying is, I may go through the motions of praying, but is my heart really in it? Yeah, that's knocking at the door of what the easiest aspect of praying is. But take it even one step further than that. Right. Yeah, so Joe says, just praying in snippets, just throwing up a quick prayer for momentary need, as opposed to being regular in it. Yeah. Here, let me take it one step further for you. Quitting. That's the easiest aspect of prayer. Quitting. Right? I mean, that's the implication behind him having to tell us, be steadfast, persist, don't give up, persist in prayer. Giving up is the easiest aspect of prayer, I think. And I think Ian and Joe were right there at the doorstop. On the porch there, knocking on the door. That's the way you see that is we probably don't completely not pray, but we go through the motions. We just throw up quick prayers and that's it. There's nothing regular about it. So anyway, let me ask you this question. This next question here. Does the need, and these are serious questions, I'm not joking here, because we need to think through this. Does the need to persist in prayer suggest that God is reluctant to give us what we ask? Okay, so Nick says, no, it doesn't indicate that he's reluctant to give us what we ask. It indicates that we need to continually be in communication with him. We need that relationship with him, regardless of whether we're receiving what we ask for or not. And that's true. But let me put it this way. What Nick just nicely did was articulate our doctrinal statement. Right? I know God's not reluctant. That's part of my doctrinal statement. So Why is it that we don't pursue? If he's not reluctant to give us what we ask for, why are we reluctant? I know this. That's an extra question I just threw in there. Yes, we do. So why do we stop short? No sorry needed. Oh, wait a minute, for the record. What Ian said, I keep forgetting to repeat this. What Ian said is one of the reasons we need to persist in prayer is to express our gratitude to the Lord for what he gives us, and that in turn nurtures thanksgiving in our heart. Okay, take it away, Nick. Yeah. Right. 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 Okay. Yeah. That's very good, Nick. Nick's saying. He's saying for himself, and I think probably he was probably speaking for many of us in this room. I don't know about all. What contributes to him being reluctant? I mean, what contributes to him not persisting in prayer is the fact that a lot of times I don't see the answers. It can seem like God's not answering my prayers, and I'm lazy, so I don't pray because it feels like his prayer doesn't get answered, or that God's reluctant to answer prayer. So yeah, I think that's a major thing behind our struggle to persist. Pam, you were next. Right. Yeah, for us to, yeah, say that last sentence again. So that we maintain our... Yes. So Pam said one of the things that's behind her, and I think it's probably true. What Nick and Pam said is probably true for all of us here. One of the problems with persisting or one of the explanations for not persisting in prayer is it's hard to maintain a relationship. It seems harder to maintain a relationship with someone that you can't see or hear. But we need to persist in prayer. Maybe God has set it up for us to persist in prayer, set it up that way, so that we will to remind remind us to be relating to Him. Yes, exactly. Exactly. That's a good point. Both those are very good points. I can see just this eagerness from Seth to jump in here. Right.
So both of those are happening. Take me in my mind as God is emphasizing this need. This is how, this is the vehicle. I would be tempted to cut my current life, but not because I think that God would have.
Right. Yes. Right. So Seth is saying that it's clear from Scripture that God has ordained the means of getting God's ordained the means of God giving us things as prayer. And so when we feel like we're not getting what we want through prayer, we try other means. And we just walk away from prayer because we're trying other means to get what we want. Exactly. So that first passage that Seth referred to is Luke 11:13. You don't give your kids a stone when they ask for bread. Do you think the Heavenly Father is a worse giver than an earthly father? Of course not. Then in chapter 12, verse 32 of Luke, after telling them the Father knows what they need and he will provide us with what we need, then he follows up with this verse in verse 32 of chapter 12 that I just absolutely love. Jesus says, "Fear not, little children. It is the Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom." Romans 8, verse 31, 32, around in that area, he says, essentially, this is just paraphrasing, essentially, he did not spare his son for us. How will he not give us all things for our spiritual benefit? And then the last passage that Seth was referring to, I'm just throwing these passages out in case you want to jot them down. James chapter 4, he says, "What causes quarrels and causes fights among you? Is it not this, that your passions are at war within you? You desire and do not have, so you murder. You covet and cannot obtain, so you fight and quarrel. You do not have because you do not ask. You ask and do not receive because you ask wrongly to spend it on your passions." Now, that is a jumping off point. I think that is incredibly important. Those first three verses there, in James, I think that's incredibly important and to me, shows the importance of God setting it up, ordaining the means of prayer, us coming to Him and asking Him for help, us coming to Him and sharing with Him our concerns, and Him helping us through answering our prayers. I think He ordained those means because of the benefits that it supplies. And I think these benefits is exactly what James is referring to in those three verses in James 4. Notice in that third question there, I ask, what are the benefits, if any, of having to persist in prayer? And I think Ian and Pam touched on a couple of those benefits. Pam. Bingo. Yes, and so I think, yes, and that's very much on this present question. I think there's two benefits related to what Pam just pulled out of James 4 there. One of them is that persisting in prayer. Now, I'm not saying giving up and going elsewhere and try to get our wants met. I'm saying persisting in prayer it enables us to weed out improper requests. Think about that. When we persist in prayer, that gives us time over. Oh, that gives us a length of time to think about the propriety or impropriety of that request. Just like Pam was saying, it's not that he's not reluctant, it's just that it's an improper request. And by setting it up so that we keep coming to him, persisting in prayer, it gives us time to come to that realization. This is an improper request. This isn't right. Also, and I think related to that also, is it helps us to refine and purify our requests. Helps us to refine and purify our requests. So maybe it's a proper request, but it helps us to focus more precisely what it is that we need. Right. 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 Think about this. What would it be like in our relationship with God if He just immediately gave us everything we asked? Well, let me ask it a different way. In an analogous way, you parents, what would it be like in your relationship with your kids if you just immediately gave them everything they asked for? Think about that. Probably don't have to think hard and long on that one, what that would be like. So, yeah, James tells us, You don't have because you don't ask. And when you do ask, you ask wrong. You're just asking to spend it on your lusts. That's what you're asking for. So God not just jumping and answering every request immediately helps us to think about what we're asking. Helps us, gives us time to come to a realization. This isn't really right. This is just something that I'm asking wrong. I just want to I've got this lust for this and I just want this. And that's why I'm asking God for it. See, here's what I'm saying. Here's what I'm saying. When we persist in prayer, that implies, I think, it implies we're walking daily with Him, persisting in our prayer. And more than likely, we're spending time in His Word. I'm not quantifying any of this, okay? I'm just saying, if we're going to be doing what Paul says, persist in prayer, watching in it with thanksgiving. If we're doing verse 2, that gives us time to examine our reasons for why we're asking for things. It gives us time to purify and refine and better focus our requests, right? Those are two important benefits. What are some other benefits? I'm sorry, pardon? Oh, humbles us. Sorry, I didn't hear that. Yes, humbles us. Yes, yes, absolutely. Nick says it humbles us. It cultivates this sense of utter dependence on Him, doesn't it? It humbles us. If He was just a vending machine, no humility there. You just go up and kick the machine and out pops what you want. Mary. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Mary says it helps you grow in your relationship with the Lord, communing with Him and learning more about Him. And one of those, I think part of that is that it awakens us to His graciousness, because we're presumptuous people. And to where He's got it set up, where we need to persist in prayer, not because He's reluctant, but because He wants us to understand the absolute indescribable graciousness of what He gives us. Even our bread to eat, our breath. Everything He gives us is out of His grace. And persisting in prayer like that in verse 2 helps us to realize and to stay focused on the graciousness of His gift. And that works back to what Ian was saying. It cultivates gratitude in us. How, try this one on for size. Persisting in prayer prepares us to receive it. It prepares us to receive it. And that's just a way of probably taking elements of several things that's already been mention it prepares us, because we are dependent on Him. It cultivates that dependency. It cultivates gratitude. It makes us not presumptuous. It cultivates patience, doesn't it? Let me ask you this. If you think about this, if you just gave your kids everything they asked for immediately when they asked for it, what kind of character would that give? What kind of frame of mind would that put them in as far as receiving it? They'd be presumptuous and impatient, wouldn't they? They'd feel entitled. And so I think the persisting in prayer, God not just responding immediately to every request when we ask it, helps prepare us to receive His gracious gift. Here's another one. By persisting in prayer, it helps us to learn to wait on God's good timing for the gift, for the request. In other words, it's not a matter of Him being reluctant. It's a matter of there's better timing for giving you this. So I think all of those are benefits to prayer. Benefits for having to persist in prayer. So this is what I had to think about. You know, I had to fess up that yes, my giving up easily in prayer. Couple of major things behind it are what Nick and Pam said. It doesn't feel like He's answering my prayer. It's hard to keep doing that with someone you can't see or hear and all of that. By the way, that's why it's important to be in the Word. Because the Word, get this, the Word is God's fresh voice to us. Pam was telling me about this sermon by Legan Duncan that she was listening to. Duncan was talking about that to someone about God's Word, and the person said, "But I want to hear God audibly." And so Duncan said, "Then read the Word out loud." But it makes that great point that this is God's fresh Word to us. Do you see how being in His Word and persisting in prayer, how they work together? So anything else you want to add to what are the benefits of having to persist in prayer? That's right. So what Seth said, the other thing that he was thinking about is God is doing something much larger than what's right in front of my face, than what I can see. I like the way Piper puts it. When God's doing one thing, He's doing 1,000 things. We don't know all that God's doing. But as Seth said, what I do know is He put me in His kingdom, in His family, and I'm involved in that. And my praying is involved in that. And persisting in prayer helps me keep that in front of me, that what God is doing is much larger than what I can see, but it's exciting. It's wonderful to be a part of it, even though I can't see the whole thing. And it's good. Yes. Yes. So, for all of those reasons, we need to persist in prayer. I don't know why verse 2 hasn't hit me like that before. But it did this time. I don't think we're going to get out of verse 2. But that's okay. That next question, the idea of being watchful in it, that is being watchful in persistent prayer, has the idea of remaining awake and alert. So remaining awake and alert in our praying. Look at, this will probably be the last question we hit. Look at Matthew. Well, just you can turn there if you want to. But Matthew 26:41. I jotted down three verses there, because these three verses all use that same word for watchful, being awake and alert. In Matthew 26:41, Jesus says this. He says, watch and pray. This is in the Garden of Gethsemane. He took the disciples there and he took those three with him, and he comes back and finds them asleep. And in verse 40, he says to Peter, so could you not watch with me 1 hour? Verse 41, watch and pray that you may not enter into temptation. The spirit is indeed willing, but the flesh is weak. So watch and pray. Then in Ephesians 6:18, Paul writes, praying at all times in the Spirit with all prayer and supplication, to the end, keep alert with all perseverance. That's our word, with all watchfulness. Keep alert, I'm sorry. Keep alert is our word for watchful. To that end, keep alert with all perseverance, making supplication for all the saints. And then in 1 Peter 5:8, he says, be sober-minded, be watchful. Your adversary, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion, seeking someone to devour. So, when we come to Colossians chapter 4, verse 2, and Paul says, continue steadfastly in prayer, being watchful in it. What does that imply to you? Nick. Yeah. So what does that mean for us to be watchful? How do we do? What are we doing? So being awake and alert to temptations and to the particular temptation of giving up on praying. Seth. Oh. anybody else? Ian. Right. So being ready, Ian said, being ready, being awake and alert, so when we see things that need, see needs or something that needs to happen, we can beseech God about it. Yes, it's, I think part of it is exactly that, where we are being awake and alert to things that are going on with a particular focus of God's kingdom. What God's doing, what we know of what He's doing and what's going on, and we're alert to those things. We're awake to those things in our praying. So they show up. Our alertness to what's going on around us spiritually is, and obviously I don't mean to exclude what's going on around us physically, because we're whole creatures. When things happen to us, they happen physically and spiritually. So we're alert to what's going on around us and the spiritual implications, and those are making, those things are showing up in our praying. Does that make sense? So persist in prayer. Be awake and alert in it. And then he says, with all thanksgiving. And so, whoops, that was me. So we'll start with that next week. We'll talk about why Paul added this little phrase here at the end with thanksgiving, and how do we do that? How do we persist in prayer, being awake and alert in it with thanksgiving? How do we do that? Why do we do that? All that. So we'll start with that question next week.